think very carefully about network, layer, security, cybersecurity kill chain, and the MITRE ATT&CK framework. But that's all the time we've got for today. I'll have to go into those other topics on another show.
You've been listening to Breakfast Bites, a program designed to help you navigate computer technology and the internet. The show airs the first and third Saturdays of every month and is hosted by Felicia King. To contact Felicia, visit her website, qualityplusconsulting.com.
This is WGTD. You are listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Mike Falkowski, a former KUSD school board member, Sammy Rangel, the life technician and executive director of Life After Hate, Steve Brown, a retired professor of educational leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School superintendent, Joe Manji. Now here's today's Education Matters moderator.
Hello, I'm Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. Today, we have a special guest joining us from Kansas to talk about the history of education in the United States, to help bring us some perspective on the pandemic, on topics that are taught in schools, and other issues that might be on the minds of listeners, as our schools are again the focus of many of our best efforts to improve our society. So the guest is Dr. John Rury. He is a historian of American education and also conducts research in education policy studies, especially regarding metropolitan schools. He is particularly concerned with inequality in education, past and present. He was educated at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, where he earned his PhD in 1982, and also the City University of New York and Fordham University for his master's and bachelor's degrees. Prior to coming to the University of Kansas in 2003, he taught at DePaul University in Chicago, Ohio State University, Antioch College in Ohio, and Wayne State University in Detroit. He also spent a year as a visiting scholar at the University of Michigan. And he's won many, many different awards, but I think for our purposes right now, the most interesting one is that you are a Fulbright Scholar in Hungary, which maybe we'll get to talk about a little bit. So welcome, Dr. Rury.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
So we actually have a very special connection in our past in the person of Dr. Carl Kasel. What is your connection with him?
Many years ago, when I was in New York City writing a master's thesis on African-American education in the early 19th century, I came across a book just published, 1973, by a young assistant professor at the University of Wisconsin named Carl Kasel. And I was so impressed. And it was a book about New York City and the development of the school system there. And it didn't really deal with African-American education, but it dealt with the larger system. And I was very impressed. So when I applied for PhD programs, that was one of the schools I applied to, and it turned out that's where I went. And so I arrived there in the fall of 1975 and met Carl. And I believe I was the first person to actually go to Madison to study with him. Many people came later, but he had some students that he picked up who were already there. But of course, that was the start of a long lifelong relationship. So,
right. And my connection with him is that he was my graduate advisor for my PhD, which was at the University of Chicago, because he was at Madison for about 25 years, left and came to Chicago for about 5 years, and then left for Brown University. And so we finished long distance. And that's where he retired from Brown University. So we'll talk maybe a little bit more about Dr. Kasel at the end of the program and sort of how he's influenced our work and really the field in general. But I wanted to invite you here today to talk to listeners about recent events involving schools and teaching that might be echoes of the past. Mm-hmm. So I recently asked you for a copy of your newest article about educational tests for immigration. Can you tell us a little bit about that work and what you've learned?
Well, immigration, you know, has been a controversial issue in American history many times. And this research deals with the turn of the century, the 1890s and early 1900s, actually up through the First World War. Now, it's interesting in that the opposition to immigration at that time, at least in the article that you're talking about, came from very elite, highly educated individuals on the East Coast. Whereas today, much of the opposition comes from other people in sort of other social positions, right? They tend to be, many of them, blue-collar workers. They feel threatened by the immigrants, or they feel like there's higher crime because of immigration. This, of course, has been promoted by the past administration in D.C. But back in the 1890s, the concern was that, I mean, they had many of the same concerns, but the people expressing it tended to be college-educated and very prejudicial, you know, in a variety of ways, some similar ways. But one of the theories that they had was that people from certain countries were less socially desirable than others, because there was just millions of people were coming to the United States at this time. But they didn't like certain people from certain nations, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans. They favored the Northern and Western European groups.
Mm-hmm. And what I think is interesting is when you say college educated people in the 19 teens, that was a very tiny percentage of the total US population. Hardly anyone, yes. Right? I mean, most people right. didn't even have a high school education at that point. So
right. At that time, you know, it's only about 250,000 people a year graduating from high school. So from mm-hmm. it was even smaller. So maybe, you know, less than 5% of the population we're talking right. about. And these were people from Harvard. These were Boston Brahmins. You know, they founded this group called the Immigration Restriction League. And some historians have described it as the nation's first think tank. Mm-hmm. Now they say that because this group conducted its campaigns against certain immigrants by producing research and publishing pamphlets and little booklets that described the problems in statistical terms. So they would link certain groups to slum conditions or to criminal behavior or to mental health problems. So the solution that they came up with, this is sort of the thrust of the article, was to propose a literacy test for immigration, with the rationale being that the immigrants who were illiterate were far more likely to, you know, become criminals or have, you know, fall into poverty, reside in the slum conditions. And they produced statistics to corroborate that. Mm-hmm. So this was what they were doing.
So is there anything like this in today's immigration system that you're aware of?
Well, yeah, there are groups that you know, will argue that we had the former president, Donald Trump, who would make sweeping generalizations about the bad hombres, right, coming from Mexico, and there would be cases of convictions for murder or for rape or things like that. But they turns out they were isolated. Actually, the research, social scientists, today we have a much more robust academic field of social science, right, than at the turn of the century, but I mean at the 1900. So the research that we have today actually shows that the immigrants from Mexico and elsewhere have much lower crime rates than the general population. But that may have been true in 1900, but nobody was really refuting the IRL, Immigration Restriction League, on a consistent basis. And so they managed, the IRL managed to get several in the 1890s and early 1900s, and then in the teens, they got Congress to pass very, you know, this literacy requirement as a strategy of immigration restriction. But the bills were vetoed, first by President Cleveland, then by President Taft, and then by President Wilson. And it was in 1917 that the Congress finally overrode the veto. So in 1917, there was actually it became law. The immigrants had to pass, you know, take this literacy test. They could be literate in their own language, didn't have to be in English. But then at that point, I mean, this is the interesting about the article, is the IRL decided that the literacy test wasn't good enough. So they beyond that, they pushed for just total restriction. Mm-hmm. And succeeded in 1924. And this was the other point of the article, was that in 1908, the IRL shifts its argument from nationalities to what they called race. Mm-hmm. So they about racial groups, and they talked about the Mediterranean races versus the Nordic races, or the Alpine races, you know, sort of the same thing as the Mediterranean in their lingo at the time. And so this was part of the eugenics movement, which is historically this set of ideas that people have these underlying biological characteristics that define their character and abilities. And of course, this is a long history of this, and regarding black versus white in this country. And so the eugenics movement just sort of extended that to immigrant groups. So already by around 1910, the IRL is arguing against certain immigrant groups based on these racial ideas. So that eventually leads them to say, well, literacy doesn't really matter. These are racial traits, so we have to just have a general ban on certain groups.
Right. And if we think about the groups we're talking about at the turn of the last century, a lot of them are from Eastern and Southern Europe, right?
Yes.
So in modern day Poland, Italy, those sorts of places, Ireland probably still. It took a while.
Ireland is considered, the Irish are an interesting case, right? But by 1900, the Irish are pretty well established. They start mm-hmm. 1840s and 50s. So, you know, by the latter 1800s, you have an Irish mayor in New York, you've got policemen. In 1900, the largest single ethnic group of teachers in New York City were Irish. Mm. So the Irish had become pretty well established, and they controlled the Catholic Church. And so they were, by that time, the anti-Irish sentiment had really diminished substantially. Mm-hmm. So the new groups, the Italians, the Eastern Europeans, the Hungarians, the Czechs, the Poles, the Russians. See, the Russian Jews, very large group, right? Very poor. Mm-hmm. And many of them lacking, there's a strong, the irony of all this is that, of course, if you read Jeff Merle's very good book, Patriotic Pluralism, that these groups, once they get established, get a foothold and start sending their kids to school, they flourish. The kids of the Russian Jewish people who come in large numbers in the early 20th century, by the 1920s and 30s, those kids are excelling mm-hmm. in school. And of course, Oppenheimer, you have all these famous scientists, right, that come out of that tradition. City College in New York, where I went to school, for a long time was known as the People's Harvard and the Poor Man's Harvard, and sent more students on to PhD degrees than any other institution in the country for a couple decades. And it was all this, it was these students that the IRR was trying to keep their parents out of the country. So,
I will maybe get into your new project about testing for school accountability, but I'm really interested, since we're talking about the 1900s, about, this year we've had the COVID-19 pandemic, which has been an enormous factor affecting schooling. So I'm wondering if you can tell us anything about the 1918 flu pandemic and how it affected schools at the moment and over the long term.
That's a great question. Of course, a lot of people are wondering about it. So the 1918, and I just want to say at the outset, the historians of education have not really looked at this. So I'm sure that some will. And it's a great dissertation topic for everybody out there who, happens to be interested in doing that. But it's a very interesting, it's the first, 50 million people worldwide, at least, probably more than that, die as a consequence of this pandemic, but only, and I put that in quotes, about 650,000 in the United States. So in that respect, that pandemic domestically was, you know, about 50% greater than what we have from this one so far, you know, about 400,000 deaths. Now, but the, here's the thing, that it's a little bit different, right? So the largest group to suffer in 1918 was the younger adults, 20 to 40. Mm-hmm. The largest group of them were soldiers. And so it spread very rapidly. And so one theory about the 1918 pandemic is that, and the way it hit young adults is that it seems to have triggered an overreaction of the immune system in that age group. So with very deadly consequences, and particularly when they were crowded together, you know, on troop ships and in the trenches and so on. So, and actually, you know, the first case, according to many, the first recorded case was in Kansas, was in one of the military installations in the state. So then it's called the Spanish flu because it got a lot of publicity in Spain, and King Carlos, you know, got sick. And so there was a lot of, you know, public attention, and so it became known as the Spanish flu, but actually the first recorded case was in the U.S. in Kansas. Mm-hmm. So, but at a military base. So the other thing is that it didn't really hit school age kids very hard. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there was a great deal of public concern. But it's interesting, you know, Woodrow Wilson was president. He never even said anything about it. Mm-hmm. So it didn't reach that level at that time. They didn't have the government didn't have the sort of social welfare orientation then that it does now, mm-hmm. which is a product of the 30s, the New Deal, and then later the 60s.
Well, and this is really mostly pre-vaccine. There were some forms of inoculation, there were people were used to having epidemics of various kinds, maybe not pandemics.
I wouldn't say used to, but they mm-hmm. did occur, and mm-hmm. they weren't really recorded very well till the late 19th century. Mm-hmm. And of course, they go way back in history. I read just the other day, you know, Cortez's miraculous victory against the Aztecs and was today Mexico. Well, actually, the Aztecs caught the flu bug from the Spanish, and that's what defeated them.
Right.
But so this is Guns, Germs, and Steel, right? The famous book, but Jared Diamond. In 1918, there were vaccines then, but they just hadn't, they couldn't develop them overnight, you know, like we can here today. So schools were closed in many places, at least for a while. New York City decided not to, and without disastrous effects. So people did wear masks, and there was what we call social distancing practiced. Mm-hmm. Of course, they didn't have Zoom. They didn't have
right
as an alternative. And so the mayor of New York at the time said, well, if the kids aren't in school, they're going to be running on the streets. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're going to be getting sick and exposed and who knows what. So if they're in school, at least we have an idea of where they are and we can take measures to try to control their exposure and so on. Mm-hmm. And monitor their health.
So it would be really interesting to hear, you know, what happened to, you know, for somebody who really wanted to dig into the archives to sort of see what happened to the kids whose parents died, because that's prime age for parents, ages 20 to 40. So I would imagine there were a decent number of 1918 flu orphans.
In
that category,
you have to remember the biggest group of people to get it were the soldiers, right?
Right.
So yes, there were families. Now I would guess in that case, you know, other family, aunts and uncles, mm-hmm. come into play, and or else orphanages, you know, sort of thing, probably.
Right. Okay, so I just need to do a quick reintroduction. You're listening to WGTD HDFM. I'm your host, Karen Sconzert, and this is Education Matters. This discussion of the history of education with Dr. John Murray of the University of Kansas is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. You are invited to listen again, or you can find our WGTD Education Matters Facebook page and join in a discussion there. So I'm sure you are aware that Wisconsin has a voucher program. It probably started or was being talked about at least when you were a student at UW-Madison, possibly. I don't know. But it has been operating in the city of Milwaukee since 1990 and is often described as the oldest voucher program in the United States. Is it?
Well, you know, the voucher idea goes back to the 50s and 60s, and there were experiments with it before Milwaukee. So now Milwaukee is unique insofar as it's a policy that was came down from the state legislature, and it was sort of an experiment, but it's been ongoing. So I think in terms of a formal policy affecting a city and a state in the way that it has, I think it can claim that status, or status as a first. I should say, Karen, I don't know, I mean, you didn't mention, but I was involved in a major project looking at the history of the Milwaukee schools. Mm-hmm. And we published a book called Seeds of Crisis, Public Education, Public Schools in Milwaukee Since 1920. The book was published in 93, but the project started in the late 80s when I first came to Chicago, 1988. And 87, 88, a guy named Sam Yarger was the dean of the School of Education at UWM. And Frank Castle was the chair of the history department. So those, we pulled together a team of folks at the university there. And Paul Peterson who was at the University of Chicago and then went to Harvard. Paul was one of our authors also. This is when Howard Fuller became superintendent in Milwaukee, that era. Mm-hmm. So it was the era immediately preceding the voucher movement there that we wrote about. And we had a big conference in early 90s, just when the vouchers were starting, of assessing the state of the Milwaukee school. So I know something about the history of education in Milwaukee and some of the circumstances of the voucher starting. And it's very interesting because Paul Peterson was then and remains today a big advocate of the voucher idea. Mm-hmm. The rhetoric at the time, there was a big national debate about this issue, as you can imagine. And I remember my wife's family was from Wisconsin, and one of her brother-in-laws was always saying, well, yeah, the schools just need competition. That's going to take care of all the problems. The market, you know, the marketplace will bring out the very best of everybody, and the public schools need competition. And this was just going to be the magic bullet that was going to improve everything, just shape those schools up. And I remember talking with Paul Peterson about this and commenting on the social science research, you know, going back to James Coleman in 1968, who found that the major determinant of school achievement was not the schools, or I should say the major determinant of variation in achievement was not the schools, but was family background. And when you have large numbers of families that are low income or below the poverty line, as you do in most central city communities, and Milwaukee, of course, is one of the most racially segregated and concentrated poverty communities in the country, it was then also, that's an enormous lift for the schools to try to raise the achievement level of those kids, you know, without an enormous infusion of additional resources. And he just waved his hand and said he saw no reason why the schools couldn't do better if they're motivated by competition, or if they can see the better ways of doing things and so on. And of course, now we know the history, right? That the voucher policy has not transformed the public schools in Milwaukee in the profound way that it was projected to. And of course, there were problems with it with the voucher schools, right? I mean, many of them didn't do as well as they had planned, and there was some corruption and malfeasance, and so the vouchers have not produced the revolution that they were supposed to in terms of the school is the bottom line. Now, of course, we still have, as I was talking about before the show, about we have an administration that came in 2016, and Betsy DeVos and she's a big school choice advocate, right? That's the softer way of describing the voucher idea, right? So, and Michigan has undergone this big transformation of the public schools in Detroit, and we see the same thing, the same kind of situation. Detroit makes Milwaukee look like a much smaller problem. I mean, in terms of concentrated poverty, it's really severe.
Right. So another area of concern in Wisconsin at this time is just a general teacher shortage. So can you tell us anything about the cycle of teacher shortages and surpluses and some of the historical remedies for making sure that there are enough teachers around?
Well, there's always been a teacher shortage. there are ups and downs, right? So, United States has had a long, long history of underinvesting in the teaching profession. Goes back to it's tied in with the, in my view, I just actually co-authored a lengthy article about this, the United States has almost 14,000 separate school districts, and each one of them has its own sort of policy about teaching. Now, about teacher qualifications and hiring teachers. And there are state level, this is a state level policy issue. Teacher requirements are set at the state level, but all kinds of flexibility is given to districts to do things. Short-term basis, emergency basis. I remember, I lived in Chicago for many years while teaching DePaul. My spouse was a teacher at Roberta Clemente High School, which was, right in the Humboldt Park neighborhood. So many of her colleagues were long-term substitutes, who hadn't been certified, right? But they're hired as, so it was full-time substitutes as FTS or FTB, the classification. And they were wonderful people, and they worked well with the kids, but the fact that they often lacked strong academic background in their subject fields undoubtedly had an effect. So you mentioned, the testing book. So, I'm in the midst of writing this book about standardized testing, and leading up to NCLB. But, the United States, one of the big problems that people noticed or caught public attention was the fact that U.S. kids do relatively poorly on international tests. Math science study, TIMSS, or PISA, these are the two big programs. Now, the math side, the TIMSS project, which is based at Boston College, and I had a chance to go talk to those folks. It was very interesting. But, they collect all kinds of data on curriculum and on teacher qualifications and so on. And more than half of the people who teach mathematics in the United States. And the kids, this is one of the big problems. The U.S. kids don't do well in math. And of course, the Asian kids do better. Now, there's all kinds of issues with the sampling on the tests and so on. But even if you control for that, the American kids are not doing that well. And certainly not given the amount of resources that get spent on schools in the United States compared to other places. But a very large percentage of American teachers who teach math don't have math degrees or even much coursework in mathematics. So the old saying about the old critique of the American curriculum, it's a mile wide and an inch deep, mm-hmm. right? We cover a lot, right, very quickly, but don't go into depth. And this hurts the mathematical capabilities of our students. And the same can be said about many, other fields. A lot of history is taught by when I was in high school, the history course I took was taught by the football coach. Mm-hmm. He had a very schematic way of teaching history. Now, I did very well because, I read history constantly as a kid, but the course itself wasn't really very much. So I would say that, going back to the 19th century, it was sort of, well, can the teacher spell? Can the teacher pronounce things? Can the teacher control the class? These are the qualifications. And for a long time, American teachers, the majority of American teachers didn't have college degrees until after World War II. They were trained in normal schools, which for a long time were glorified high schools. There's the well-known critique of schools of education from an academic point. So this is a persistent, when you say there's a shortage of teachers, well, you're talking about willingness of people to come into the profession. What I'm talking about is people who are really prepared to teach in a more meaningful way.
Well, you'll be happy to know that one of the solutions that the legislature decided on is to allow someone who has a license in any field to take a test, a subject test, to qualify them to get another license in a different field. So if you, for example, have a history license and you want to make sure that you can keep teaching, you can take the Praxis 2 test for math. And if you pass it, and then the school district says, yep, they're doing okay teaching math, then you can get a math license.
Right.
So, yeah. And that sometimes means that you're quite good at explaining math to other people, but it does not necessarily mean that. And so it's an interesting remedy.
Well, I would say it's a Band-Aid, right? It's
right.
And, the research on this is pretty clear. I mean, there's been a lot of research on math education and the amount of coursework that a teacher has in math is a very strong predictor of the achievement of their kids, the math achievement of their kids, of their students. And frankly, the same thing is true in history. I mean, so it's hard to teach what you don't know. Mm-hmm. Well, you can teach algebra if you, but for kids who, this is the other thing I worked at the Spencer Foundation for 4 years and, so I got an up close look at a lot of the research on these issues, and Spencer Foundation funds research and education, and just for the audience. Mm-hmm. We had a whole project with the lesson study. The Japanese, do this practice called lesson study. And the Japanese teachers that we went and observed these sessions and where they work out lessons and the whole focus was on depth of understanding and letting the kids really work with numbers and getting wrong answers and then spending a long time discussing what was wrong about the answer rather than trying to cover 50 topics, you know, in the course of 10 weeks, moving quickly from one to the other, they took the kids in depth. And then, and the consequence was that the kids come away with a much stronger sense of numbers and working with numbers and figuring things out and confidence in doing that. And that makes the coverage dimension much easier to accomplish and more effective. And that's what and of course, to do that, you need math teachers who have a really greater depth of understanding.
That's right.
Yeah, do that in the mathematics involved.
So I just want to remind our listeners that I'm talking about the history of education with Dr. John Murray at the University of Kansas. And if you want to listen again, you can find this recording at wgtd.org on the Education Matters page. So we only have a few minutes left. I would just like to talk to you a little bit about some of the things that are coming up in state legislatures right now, which include some attempts to limit the kinds of things that are taught specifically in history and social science courses. So the first, it started out being something about what is known as the 1619 Project, which is sort of an insert publication of the New York Times Magazine. And now it's kind of morphed into something that is being called critical race theory, but doesn't seem, probably isn't that, because critical race theory is actually a legal theory. So so I wonder if you could tell our audience whether people have tried to do this in the past. Have there been attempts at sort of censoring particular topics or other things like that in the curriculum?
Oh yeah, I mean, this is a long, long history. And there's a good book called The History Wars going back to the 1930s, you know, in the 1980s, the period that I'm looking at now for my testing book, we had what's called the standards movement, which was the idea that each state should develop explicit standards that they wanted everybody to try to achieve in their courses and various subjects. And then the idea was that then testing, the testing program could be linked to these standards and measure how well it was being done. So of course the lead on this was the mathematicians. And so the NCTM, National Council of Teachers of Mathematics, along with the college math people, put together the standards that were very influential and really were sort of leading the way. Well, out of that, the history standards, there was a similar effort from the NCSS, National Council of Social Studies, the American Historical Association, the Organization of American Historians, all got together. And there's a Society for the Teaching of History, right? All these groups got together and they formed a big task force. And this was headed up by a guy named Gary Nash, who's a professor of history at UCLA. And they came up with standards that represented the state of historical scholarship at that time. This is the early 1990s. And so it really emphasized along with the, you know, growth of the United States and the political tradition of freedom and so on. It also focused on many of the, this is the social history movement within the history field, the problems of assimilation, the problems of racial discrimination, the problems of inequality that have, you know, women, the fight for women's rights, you know, all of those issues that historians have really worked so hard to document in the last 4 or 5 decades were also touched upon. So part of this research was funded by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And when a new director came in, to that agency named Lynn Cheney. She took a look at these history standards and she was very unhappy with them. She thought that they were
I just want to say for listeners, you might recognize that last name. So the vice president.
Yes, this is the wife of Dick Cheney, right?
And also the mother of Liz Cheney, who is currently in the Congress. So
anyway, she was very unhappy with the history standards. She went to the, Congress and she, presented this to the United States Senate, who in a vote of 99-1 condemned the history standards as being unpatriotic and unrepresentative. You know, there was a debate in Texas about slavery I was listening to a radio show talking with the Board of Education in Texas, the State Board of Education, and one of its members, this woman, said, well, we have our own facts that we want to emphasize, and we're not going to emphasize slavery is not one of them. So, and there was an attempt to call them imported workers, or,
Well, I can tell you from 35 years of working with high school students and early college students that telling them not that they can't learn something is a surefire way to get them more interested. So I would caution people who would like to bring more attention to something that they don't want taught, because odds are, first of all, the kids weren't all that interested to begin with, but then once you make it a taboo subject, then they want to learn it even more.
That's intriguing then, right? Yes.
Yes. Absolutely. So right. We only have really like a minute left, so we're going to have to be quick about this. Because we share the history of working with Dr. Carl Kasel, let's talk a little bit about sort of what he did and sort of seminal things that he sort of pointed the field of history of education in as our parting words.
Absolutely. Well, Carl had a huge effect on me. There was, his first book, Evolution of an Urban School System, about the roots of New York City, which of course is the groundwork for education systems in cities. His book, co-authored book, Education and Social Change in Massachusetts. I've, worked on that with him as an assistant, and, of course, then his book a little bit later, Pillars of the Republic, which is about common schooling. So he's been foundational to the field, certainly on big influence on myself in terms of being a social historian. He then went on to study literacy, and now he's looking at federal politics of education. So he's just been prolific.
And I know, and some listeners may remember this, there was a PBS series about the history of American public schooling. And
Scaramondale, yes, did that.
Yeah, and it's a four-hour series. I use it sometimes. I use excerpts of it in my courses. And Dr. Kasel is interviewed throughout, and it's really interesting to see the footage of him from, must have been the late 90s when they filmed that. So that's another place where, sort of he's immortalized in a film. So quickly, what are your parting words for people who are concerned about schools today? And what are some places they can look if they want to learn more about schools of the past? Something that would be sort of an easy read for somebody who's not a historian.
Okay, well, I would, in terms of getting involved today, we have all these school districts. So look at what you're doing, what your district is doing, and how is it dealing with these issues in terms of how is it hiring its teachers? Is there diversity in the curriculum and in the teaching force? And, what are they doing about the achievement gap? We didn't get to talk about that, but that's a huge manifestation of inequality. Quick reads on the history of education. I'm sure Dr. Karen can help out with that.
You've been listening to WGTD HDFM. This discussion of the history of education with Dr. John Murray of the University of Kansas is archived at WGTD.org on the Education Matters page. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org. You're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page.
Supporting WGTD is the Bristol Renaissance Fair, featuring an open-air marketplace, food, drink, and non-stop entertainment, all in the style and pageantry of 16th century England, online at renfair.com, open weekends through Labor Day. Support comes from the Bristol Renaissance Fair. Eat, drink, and be merry. Succulent treats, sinful sweets, dashing and clashing knights, music and laughter. The Bristol Renaissance Fair is open weekends through Labor Day.